supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Gambling, as defined as gaming, is permitted by law. In the greater Philadelphia area, there's growing access to gaming, from scratch-off lottery tickets to slots and table games. Gamblers, too, come in a variety of styles. There's the professional, the counter, the casual social, then there's the more serious social gambler, and there's also the compulsive gambler. 21,000 of them call Pennsylvania's gambling helpline each year. And of course, no one knows how many never make that call. Callers, surprisingly to me anyway, tend to prefer scratch-offs and slots. Most report financial problems. Many suffer from other addictions. But whether male or female, young or old, compulsive gamblers have one thing in common. Their lives are out of control. The compulsive gambler in our land of easy access to gaming is a troubling combination that we're going to address today with our guests, Jim Pappas and C.P. Murarkey. Jim Pappas is president and CEO of the Council on Compulsive Gambling of Pennsylvania. It's a nonprofit group designated to facilitate referrals and educate us about gambling addiction. Jim joins us by phone from Harrisburg. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dan.
I'm joined here in the studio by C.P. Murarkey. He's a licensed addictions counselor who counsels patients with all sorts of addictive behaviors. C.P. was a compulsive gambler himself, and he joins me in our studio. CP, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure, Dan.
I'm not so sure I got the tense right when I said was a compulsive gambler.
Well, as the story goes, I thought I was a compulsive gambler, and after about 15 years, I realized that there's no such thing, and returned to gambling. That's sort of the situation I'm in today.
Do you call yourself recovering?
I'm a recovering compulsive gambler. You're right. There is no such thing as a was.
As a was. And later in the show, we're going to hear from a guest who's dedicated her life to helping women with gambling addiction. And, of course, we would love to hear from you and your stories about gambling, casinos. Maybe you've had it in your family. Maybe you have felt you've come close yourself, or maybe you do feel you're already compulsive. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Jim, let's start with you. How many people are problem gamblers?
National studies, Dan, indicate 1-3% of the national population are problem gamblers. In the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, we look at numbers from 3-5% for adults, but those percentages double when you're talking about adolescent or underage gamblers.
Wow. Wow. Have you seen an increase in Philadelphia since casinos have come here?
Well, statewide, we certainly have. As an example, in 2007, our helpline, which is statewide, 24/7, received about 700 calls. In current times, we're averaging over 1,800 calls a month to our helpline. Now, that is not all problem gamblers seeking help. Some of those are information seeking, but on any given month, that average is 10-20% are folks in crisis, not only the gambler, but it could be their significant other.
Is that automatically attributed to increased access? with local casinos? I wonder if the economy plays into that.
Well, we're looking at that now, both in our sister affiliate councils and the national council, with the downturn in employment, if that's having an impact, say, for lottery tickets, where there's a phenomenon. You know, a small bet can win an extremely large amount of money, but nothing really to indicate that as yet. It's just treatment dollars were made available by the casinos or gaming coming to Pennsylvania, but the problem has always been there, whether it be a horse player, card player, numbers players on the street number, et cetera.
It's wonderful, and it's complicated by that last statement you made, Jim, about the money for treatment is coming from the casinos.
Yes.
Boy, that's sure good news and bad. That's complicated.
That's true. 1.5 million per year, or 0.1%, whichever revenue is greater, the casinos collectively give to the Pennsylvania Department of Health Bureau of Drug and Alcohol Programs exclusively for gambling treatment.
I am watching CP Meraki across the table from me, and you know, he might not have his was a lawyer, and he lost his license because of the sequelae of gambling, and he's hoping to get it back soon. But you know, I'm watching his face, and he might not have a license to practice law, but he's got a lawyer's brain. So what's your reaction when I'm talking to Jim here, CP, about this money coming from casinos?
Well, Jim's first of all, he's correct, and there's never seemed to be money available to treat compulsive gamblers. Seems like there was always money to treat the drug addicts and alcoholics and other addictions. However, with the advent of the casinos coming in and the table games coming to fruition the summer before last, they needed to up the ante to treat the compulsive gamblers. The only thing I would say is the statistics do show that the closer you live to the casinos, the numbers of compulsive gamblers go up. So, you know, in this area right here, it makes a lot of sense that there should be a lot of money available, because the numbers are significant in this area.
Should we get rid of the casinos?
No.
Why?
No more so than get rid of the bars for the alcoholics.
Yeah, we tried that once, didn't we?
It sort of didn't work.
It didn't work very well. Jim, when someone calls the hotline, I would guess when they're talking about themselves, by the time they call, they're in pretty bad shape. So what is it that you're hearing on the other end of the line?
Well, on all calls, we try to keep them engaged, gather as much information as possible, and then make the appropriate suggestions or referrals. All callers, when calling with a problem with this issue, are referred to at least one, hopefully two, Gamblers Anonymous meetings within their immediate region, and or Gammonon, which is the support system similar to Al-Anon is to AA. And again, we also, doing clinical training is one of our missions, and we have a network of almost 300 professional providers that we have trained clinically to treat the issue, and we can make referrals directly to them.
We've got a caller on the line. She didn't want to talk on the air, but she works with people in long-term care and has seen seniors in these long-term facilities who are so addicted to gambling that she says they actually injure themselves if they don't win. Their lives become completely dominated by gambling. And at that age group, CP, you're reacting to that. You see that population?
I treat a lot of gamblers, and I've realized that recently the age group of between 50 and older have increased tremendously.
Why?
It seems like when there's a life change, loss of a partner, retire from a job, kids move out of the house, When there's a significant life change, people need a purpose in life, and they tend to lose that purpose, or they and they do it as a way of escaping. And you know, when you're sitting in a casino, you're scratching off a lottery ticket, or you're playing in a machine, no one's sick. You know, my cancer's in remission, or my kids don't have problems, or my husband didn't leave me, or all these things sort of go away. Now, naturally, when you leave, you have all those problems, plus whichever new ones you created while you were in there, but it's a way of escape.
Yeah, and a very effective way of escape. I found that myself. I always enjoyed gambling. And after my accident, I found that going down to the casinos and playing blackjack not only helped calm my brain down, but as a quadriplegic, was one of the few things I could do. I didn't have to pick up cards. I didn't have to go, you know, get water or diet soda. They brought it to me. And I'll tell you, thank God I don't have that gene, that addiction gene, because as my depression lifted, I went down there less often, and now I don't do it at all. It's kind of boring to me. So it was my antidepressant.
It does give you that feeling of normalization in the beginning, you know, where I can be like everyone else and do these things. And you know,
that doesn't last very long.
No, either. It doesn't.
No, it doesn't. Jim, I want to go back to you. We were talking about the older population. When I looked at your website, many of your videos were geared towards adolescent. Is there something about the adolescent brain that's drawn to gambling?
The research is still being explored on that possibility. Adolescents, by nature and growing, are followers of habit, so they would follow the examples that's set to them by their peers, and their peers who gamble, and their parents. Many parents host and go out on gambling ventures and whatever, and they talk. They hear it over the dinner table, the excitement, they won, or whatever the case may be, and they're influenced by others.
There's also, I mentioned the adolescent brain and gambling. I mean, adolescents are, their brains are more geared towards risk-taking. They like the rush. Their brains are not wired to understand consequences.
Right, exactly. And in looking at problem gamblers in adolescent ages, it's predominantly male as opposed to female. And you're right, they're risk takers, they're competitive, they want to be athletes. But again, they're lured by the attraction of a way to make easy money. Mom comes home from a trip to whatever casino that may be, or a racetrack, and talks about her winnings, and they want to do something to share that benefit with the family, and the kids are enticed by this. But also, they see it in the schools. They see it in kids their own age, the selling and buying of basketball pools, of football pools. And we see today kids are influenced by cable television as well. The phenomenon geared towards adolescents is Texas Hold'em, and you see that all over cable television.
Well, online access is
right,
pretty
exactly.
Easy. You don't have to leave your house. CP, your addiction began way before adolescence.
I started out with, even before football pools, I had an uncle that liked to gamble, and he asked me to pick a few horses. And, you know, at the age of 8 or 9, I liked the rush. I liked the instant reward of coming home and finding $10 for something that took about all of 3 seconds to do. And it just started that way. It just started with with the excitement for me. Football pools at the age of 10, 11, 12, and graduating to bookies and that kind of stuff.
You said when I read your story that you were an insecure child. When you look back, do you have a sense of what it was about you, your life, your brain or genetics? What was it about you?
They say people who are addicts, some of them grow up with that feeling of being less than. Very intelligent parents, and my father was an attorney and a judge, and my grandfather was an attorney, and I guess it was expected of me, and I wasn't sure I was willing to do all the work, so I needed to find something that I was good at, that I didn't have to put a lot of effort into, like a lot of studying into. And gambling provided that way for me, that instant gratification.
There's a lot of kids who feel less than and don't become addicts. Was there gambling in your genetics or any other compulsive behavior?
My uncle was my hero, and ex-Marine, and loved to gamble, and although it never really, looking back, created the havoc it caused in his life as it caused in my life. Somewhere along the line, you cross that invisible line where your life becomes out of control and unmanageable, and it's a hard thing to get back in line.
What were you doing in high school, in college? What was your behavior like?
I was an Eagle Scout.
Huh.
So, it wasn't the typical getting in trouble or that kind of thing. I was in the Army Reserves. I was not the guy with the long hair that, had the wig back in the 70s.
So who the hell were you? You were an Eagle Scout who was a gambling addict.
Right.
How did you do that?
I don't know. One story, we were on a camping trip, and one of these first pools that I hit, I remember asking, because I knew nothing about it. I must have been 12 years old, and I asked, how much you could win for a dollar, and he said if you pick 10 out of 10 teams, you win $200. I figured, not knowing that much, how hard could it be? And being on a camping trip and having my little transistor radio, I had 9 out of 9 winners, and I can't remember one winner, but I can remember the game I lost 40 years ago, 45 years ago. And, as a result, I won 9 out of 10 and won $20, which at the age of 11 or 12 was a lot of money. So I thought, geez, this can only get better the more I learned about this.
Can I ask you a very personal question?
Absolutely.
No, I mean it. What do you feel like in your body as you reminisce over that now? Can you feel that sensation?
It brings me back to the excitement I felt back then, but it's sort of like a false sense of security. It's not the excitement that would make me want to go and gamble today. It makes me look back and realize, I guess some of it I made a lot of bad choices along the way.
Are you still an insecure guy?
Not as much.
Yeah, me too. Tell us how you got into trouble? What got you in trouble?
I thought that, like everybody else, I guess, my gambling wasn't out of control, and what had happened was, even though I knew things were going downhill rapidly in my 30s, it took my wife to step up to the plate and say, "Listen, I'm going to take the kids and get out of here unless you get some help." And naturally, I thought she was bluffing, so I pushed the issue until one morning on December the 4th of 1984, she actually did it. And I remember being 2 o'clock in the morning and her walking around with the two kids and to her mom's, and me being alone and giving my father a call and him wanting to know if I was okay. And at that point, I called a place, it's called Belmont now. It used to be Philadelphia Psychiatric Center.
I used to work there.
Okay. At that time in 1984, I was ready. At about 3 in the morning, so I made a phone call.
That's just when they started their program. I think I might have been there.
Probably were.
In their addictions program.
Right. Third floor, Woodside Hall.
Yeah, I know it. We're going to have to take a short break. Stick with us. I want to talk more about this after our break. We're talking about gambling and problem gamblers. We're talking about its impact on the individuals. We're going to talk about its impact on the family also. My guests are C.P. Meraki, who's got his own history with gambling addiction. He lost his law license, and now he is a licensed addictions counselor. I'm also here with Jim Pappas, who's president and CEO of the Council on Compulsive Gambling. Hey, we'd love to hear from you. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Penn Medicine supports WHYY. Holidays are a time of happiness and joy, but can be difficult for those who suffer from depression, mood swings, or bipolar disorder. The Integrative Medicine and Depression Research Unit at Penn Medicine is researching better treatment for bipolar disorder, depression, and anxiety. You may be eligible for a research study of the effects of medications or natural supplements to treat these symptoms. Initial evaluations determine eligibility for participation. 215-662-3462, 215-662-3462.
Is it okay to break up with someone over email? If you're out at a restaurant, is it rude to answer your cell phone or update your Facebook status? On the next Fresh Air, we get answers from Philip Galanis, who writes an etiquette column for the New York Times and has a new book. Both are called Social Cues. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're talking about gambling and problem gambling. Who's affected most? How? Why? And what to do about it? My guests are Jim Pappas and C.P. Meraki. Our number is 888-477-9499. C.P., we're talking to you about your history, and you realized that you were addicted when your wife and family left.
Yes, that's correct.
How old was your child?
I had a daughter, Amy, at about 12 years old at the time. My son, Rick, was 5. And I'd like to say, Dan, I knew probably before that I had a problem. It just, I wasn't pushed to do something about it. And you know, denial is...
How did you know you had a problem? What were you doing?
I could see my behavior changing, you know, become this Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde character. You know, the kids would know when I won, because if I came in and I was happy and I brought gifts for everybody, they would say, oh, Daddy must have won, you know, and... You know, if I came in and I was miserable, they knew to stay out of the way. And that's not a good way to live.
How are your kids now?
They're pretty great. I always thought that, you know, maybe one of them may end up being a gambler, but doesn't seem that way.
Both adults now.
Both adults, 37, 32.
Did you have to work on your relationship with them?
When I stopped... It wasn't as bad as some others, because if you ask them, I think they'll say the relationship's pretty good. I know it's pretty good now, and even when I went back in about 2000, my relationship was still good with them, but I made poor choices back then, thinking that I could gamble a different way, and I didn't gamble the same type. I invested in the stock market and did some things and saw my life spiral out of control, and as a result, made a lot of bad decisions.
Hmm. We've got Lehar on the line. She is a volunteer for Casino Free Philadelphia and Asian Americans United. Her parents both have gambling addictions. Lehar, hi. Welcome to Voices.
Hi.
Hi. So, we're getting some feedback. Is your radio still on?
No.
Okay. So tell us what you grew up with, what it was like growing up with two parents who were problem gamblers.
I think at first it was like Atlantic City was where we used to go as, you know, a weekend trip, and we would go to the beach, and it would be a fun family gathering. And at the beginning, I never noticed it as a problem. I always thought, you know, it's just normal. All families go to the beach, and then they go inside the casinos, and then and it felt fine. But then over the years, I would notice, like, we would be left in the arcades, and it would take longer and longer for my mom or dad to come and pick us up. And so I started having a lot of anxiety as a kid, because I was the oldest child also, and I always felt like, what if they didn't come back? Or, like because we were literally left, you know, outside for hours upon hours, and there wasn't anything to really convince them to stop. And
First of all, how old were you when this was happening?
I think my earliest memories are like probably like 6 or 7, wow, around that age. And then, I would say within a year or two of that type of behavior, I kind of at a very young age, like, kind of was like, there's something wrong. And I couldn't really, didn't have the words to say, oh, it's an addiction or things like that. But it was very, very erratic behavior, like your guest just said. My mom and dad had that kind of, one minute they were fine, and the next minute you didn't know who they became. And so I did feel like I lost my parents during those years in that process.
Yeah, and you were a little girl, and you lost both parents, so you didn't have one touchstone, one safe place to
yeah.
go to. Tell us about what happened in your life, in your relationship with your parents. Take us a step further. I'm curious about what mm-hmm. happened.
Over the years, the gambling got really bad when I remember, like, saving all my money, any, like, birthday money or anything, any gift money I would receive, and I would actually just have a little box of quarters. And that's what reminds me about, like, back in the day, there's like quarters for casinos, and my dad would give me a roll of quarters to play for the video arcade. And I remember, like, having a box full of quarters and not spending it at the arcades, because I always felt like my parents might need it. And there were times that my mom did, you know, kind of take my piggy bank of sorts and need it to kind of survive, you know, like paycheck to paycheck. I kind of realized she was using grocery money or rent money.
What was happening with you?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me what it was like. What it was like being you those years?
Oh, it was terrifying. It was absolutely terrifying. It would swing from neglect, not seeing my parents at all. Like, there would be times of, like, sometimes they wouldn't come home, and so they would actually go through an entire day of they would go to work and then go to the casinos and all night long, and then go to work and go to the casinos, go to work. You know, so there would be, like, my mom was a little conscientious. Like, she would try to, like, pack lunch meats or something in the refrigerator, and she tried to make sure, like, certain things were done. But as a whole, I felt, like, completely terrified, because I didn't know when they would come home. I didn't know if anything would happen to them.
Meghar, tell us how you got through your childhood.
Through Asian Americans United, through community organizations, I got a chance to see other role models. And I was like, wow, you know, these people are different. You know, their value system is completely different. They weren't, like, I felt like my mom was in constant fear all the time about money and stress. And when you're in that situation, you have no position to think about other people. Like,
yeah.
when you're so caught up in your own issues, and the issues get worse because you're digging a deeper hole, there's no way of thinking about other people. And, like, luckily, I am so thankful, like, at 14, I got involved with this group called Asian Americans United, and it was like a community organization. And they were just so loving, and they were so generous, and they were like, you know, let's tutor young kids. And so on top of, like, my younger siblings who I looked after, like, I was came from a family of five, so I'm the oldest. On top of, you know, watching out for them, I also kind of thought about, well, what about the larger community, and there's other kids that are being left behind.
You see,
and
I think that's yeah. a critical issue, and we're going to have to say goodbye to you, but mm-hmm. I think that's a critical issue that
yeah.
you live in a community that is so close and
yes, yes.
so closely identified that, that you know, you had what we psychologists call a second chance family, and that's, you know, that is life-saving. Lehar, I want to thank you for your call and thank you for sharing your story. We've got another caller on named Sam who's got addiction in his family too.
Hello.
Hi, Sam. What can we do
for
you?
Yes, hi. I can't hear that clearly, but I want to call in because my older brother has a gambling problem. He's Asian also, and I was wondering if there's any Asian-specific or culturally sensitive issues that pertain to addicting to gambling. He has a wife and three other kids. He has lost his job and also owned two businesses, and they were also lost.
Well, let me say two things to you, Sam. One is... you know, one thing I didn't mention to Lehar, and I will mention to you, that I highly, highly recommend Gammonon. You know, CP was talking about Gamblers Anonymous. Gammonon is for friends and family of people with gambling problems. And it's just a wonderful organization, and I highly suggest it. The other point is I'm going to have to ask you to take the answer off the air because we didn't have a good connection. But I want to hear from, I guess, Jim first. Are you still there, Jim?
Yes, sir.
What about Sam's question about cultural issues with the
That certainly is significant within the Asian population. Gambling is built around that cultural, family-wise, system-wise, as it is in tribal and Native Americans. There's a lot of promoted family.
We're not hearing you so well there.
There's a lot of gambling and behavior within the Asian community that's endorsed by the family. On the downside, when you have a problem gambler like that, the Asian community, by their own culture, likes to keep their therapeutic or counseling services within the family network. They don't very often step out into a 12-step program or to a therapeutic model. I'm encouraged, though, in Philadelphia, we do clinical training, and we just finished our 30-hour Level 1 clinical training course, of which there were 6 Asian clinicians in attendance.
Well, that's good. That's certainly a good sign. I wonder about treatment and what that looks like. CP, you did your rehab, and you went to Gamblers Anonymous, but you also do counseling. So what does, should good quality treatment look like?
Well, in addition to talking about their gambling problems, and usually the gambling problem is something that's covering up something else that's going on in their life. So we try to get to those issues also.
Like what?
It could be low self-esteem, it could be a depression, it could be a traumatic event that happened in the childhood, it could be them not being satisfied with their lives right now and looking for a way to escape. It could also be looking at the way they look at things and try to get them to change their thoughts and their thought patterns.
I would also think that any kind of compulsive behavior is about intolerance of discomfort.
That instant gratification is something that they look for to take that pain away and to take that indifference away. Part of my treatment also includes if they could if they can tolerate it, is Gamblers Anonymous. Now, there are some people that don't, you know, that'll explain why they don't like meetings and why they don't like this type of thing. But, you know, we try to do it one step at a time. We try to, you know, get them into counseling first and talk about it, and then maybe get to a meeting and see what it's like, or at least a meeting online, and go from there.
What does abstinence look like?
Abstinence is good. It's not as good as recovery, but, you know, abstinence is just...
Now, what's it look like with gambling? It's the same question for Overeaters Anonymous. I know what it looks like with alcohol and drugs, but, like, what do you do with your money, for example?
Well, a lot of times to a compulsive gambler, money's a trigger. So, right. Like the overeater, you know, you can't, you know... You need to carry money. You need money in order to live, just like you need food in order to sustain yourself.
You invest in the market.
What I used to until it got me in trouble. Now I just give my money to somebody to do something.
Okay.
I try to take as many temptations away as I could. You know, I'll get into a program where they'll get into a 401 where they'll buy you mutual funds, and I stop looking at the day-to-day activity because that'll create a problem.
We're going to have to take a short break, and when we get back, we're going to be talking with Marilyn Lancelot. She also has her history of compulsive gambling and now has devoted her life to helping women who are compulsive gambling. We've been talking with Jim Pappas. He's the President and CEO of the Council on Compulsive Gambling. C.P. Meraki is an addictions counselor with his own history of addiction. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY FM.
Supporting WHYY, Elizabeth Bennett and Associates, providing personalized and discreet divorce and family law services through litigation, mediation, collaboration, and negotiation. Located in Wayne, PA. Online at ebennettlaw.com.
In this country, we often talk about illegal immigration, but what we don't often talk about is that middle ground between legal and illegal, what it's like to be in limbo.
When I was working in the fields, I remember the Immigration Naturalization Service, and they used to do all these raids, and I just knew that could be me.
Dr. Alfredo Quiñones Hinojosa is with us next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
WHYY programming is supported by the teachers and education support professionals of the Pennsylvania State Education Association, educating all children for a bright future. We are PSEA, providing the power of a great education.
We are back on Voices in the Family. We're talking about gambling, problem gambling, and its impact on families. We're with Jim Pappas and C.P. Meraki. Now we're joined by Marilyn Lancelot. She's written about her life as a compulsive gambler. She maintains a website called Female Gamblers, and she's dedicated her life, like I said, to helping women with gambling addiction. She joins us from home in Sun City, Arizona. Marilyn, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Marilyn, we heard on the first part of the show how the risk for gambling spikes around adolescence, and CP started when he was a child. But we also talked about an older population. You started gambling in the 80s when you were 53 years old and had never done anything like that before.
I don't think gambling addiction is an age-related issue, or gender or race, ethnic, anything. I mean, compulsive gambling can happen to anybody. If you're caught in the circumstances that you can't handle, and gambling can relieve it. I mean, I gambled to escape. I had very low self-esteem all my life. So when I found gambling, man, it was great.
Do you mind saying what you gambled to escape from?
Well, in the beginning, I became an alcoholic to escape from low self-esteem. And that gave me the courage and the confidence. And then I stopped that 40 years ago. And then 27 years ago, I discovered gambling. And my family, I had five children at the time, were all drug addicts or alcoholics. So I guess when I look back, the reason I went to the casinos was to leave that mess behind and go and create my own mess, I guess.
Yeah, well, you know, you describe your family. It sounds like your genes weren't from Tiffany's, shall we say.
No, they weren't. They were not jewels.
Yeah.
My parents were both alcoholics, and I watched many, many beatings of my mother and arguing all the time I was growing up.
Yeah. So, in hindsight, when and how did things get out of control for you?
For gambling?
Mm-hmm.
I went to Reno, Nevada. I lived in Yuma. Went to Reno, Nevada for a bowling tournament. And we stopped in Laughlin, Las Vegas, and then Reno. And I had never really gambled before. I was very lucky. I had what they call beginner's luck. And I won a lot of money. So I think I was hooked from that first day. I know I was.
You've got a poignant image in your book that was heartbreaking. It's an image of your grandson being when you were being arrested, handcuffed.
Right.
I believe. Right. That was many years ago. How is he doing now?
He's doing fine. He's going to school. He doesn't know if he wants to be a doctor or an attorney. He's 25 years old now, is married, and has a little boy who's just a doll. In fact, I went to a holiday party with them Saturday night, and I asked him, I said, do you remember what went through your mind when the police came and took me away? He said, you know, at 5 years old, all I could think of was cartoons on the television and the games I played. He said, I guess it didn't mean much to me at that time.
Mm.
But his mother did bring him to me to visit in prison, and he had a good time there, and he was 6 or 7 years old, and he played with the other kids in the yard, so I don't think it affected him as much as it did my children.
Boy, I'll tell you, there's something wrong with those little kids. They don't know enough to be miserable when they're supposed
to. I know.
Tell us what it was like in prison for you.
It was very scary. I was 60 years old when I went in, and I had no idea. The only thing I knew about prison was what I'd seen in the movies, and that was not a pleasant experience. It wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. I was a trustee, so I could work on the outside and earn a little money. I think I was earning 30 cents an hour. But that was a lot of money, because most inmates made 10 cents an hour.
Did you know?
But it gave me a lot of time to reflect on my gambling, I'll tell you that.
So you knew you were an addict?
I didn't know it until the police cars came and took me away.
I mean when you were in prison.
I knew it then, yes. Yeah. In fact, I was very fortunate. I had a chance to go to a 12-step program for 5 months before I entered the prison.
Mm.
So I had a good foundation. And I also had the background of AA.
I want to talk to you about your perspective on gambling. And I want to pick up on the subtitle of your book, your book, Gripped by Gambling. The subtitle is The True Story of a Woman's Journey Back from the Hell She Created. And I do want to talk about the journey back. See, Pete touched on it. But when you say the hell you created, it implies a great deal of self-blame. So how do you understand your addiction?
Well, I take full responsibility for my addiction. I don't blame it on anybody or anything. I destroyed a lot with my gambling. I lost two homes. I lost my retirement, lost my job. I destroyed a business that was doing quite well. People lost their jobs. It affected my children, my grandchildren. We had to uproot from Yuma and moved to Phoenix because there were no 12-step groups in Yuma, which I have since gone back and started one.
That's terrific. Here's where I want to weigh in on this, and I'd like to hear you and NCP comment. Now, you say there's nobody to blame but you, and of course there isn't, and CP implied the same thing when he talked about bad decisions. One of my concerns, and I'm not trying to get you off the hook, you did make bad decisions, and you did hurt a lot of people in the process, but this issue of self-blame and beating yourself up can really interfere with recovery. CP, you want to weigh in on that?
As part of my treatment plan for everybody, they have to learn to forgive themselves. They have to give themselves a break because there's, you can't change the past. I mean, you did what you did, and to go on beating yourself is just going to create a hopelessness. Mm-hmm. So you need to move on. You need to learn how to forgive yourself.
Have you done that?
I've done it,
Marilyn.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, let's take a call. We've got Bill on the line. Hi, Bill. Hi, Bill. You're on Voices.
I'm an addictionist as well as as a physician. And the only comment, I love your show and I respect you highly. I listen to you as often as I can.
Thank you.
One comment that I would have is that I think as an addictionist and dealing with patients with the disease of addiction, is that I find it that some of my many of my patients, including myself as a provider, find it offensive to call people addicts. I find that these are people who have the disease of addiction, and I don't think that a disease should define who they are, regardless of what the disease is.
I think you make a very interesting point. I'd like to hear, CP, you want to weigh in on that?
I don't think a person is defined by their addiction. There are people who are addicts, but they're also people. They're also humans. They also, have a life. And, I thought I was an attorney. And I thought that's how I was defined. And when I wasn't an attorney anymore, there was a hopelessness that came in. And then I found out that, that was only a part of my life. But it is a part of my life, as is my being an addict.
Bill, I want to weigh in on this because, I've treated people for many years that are all over the continuum. And I remember treating someone, a young woman who's life was all over the place, and she had all sorts of problems in all sorts of arenas. And, part of it, she was drinking a lot. I personally didn't think she was addicted at the time, but she declared herself an addict and started going to 12-step programs every day, which I supported. But her giving herself that label helped put her on a path. And on the other end of the continuum, I've treated people who know that they were out of control with their substance abuse but couldn't abide by that label. They went into therapy. They wouldn't go into a 12-step program. And they devoted their lives to their own healing and recovery. And so, in those cases, the label would have hurt them. I think it's the bottom line is what's going to help people? What's going to help people get some control over their lives? So
Dr. Gottlieb, I guess where I run into the difficulty is that, we in the field who are trying to help these people run into so many times of not in my backyard. I don't want that treatment program in my backyard because you're going to bring in a bunch of addicts. The word addict I find to be derogatory, and I try to tell them this is a disease. I don't even call people diabetics. They're people with diabetes. I would rather say they are people first. Of course we have diseases, but they're people first, and the disease they have should not be like a leper.
I've got to tell you something, Bill. I think you make a very important point, and I'd like to see you on the forefront of combating stigma around this and many other diseases. Thanks so much for your call, and thanks so much for the work you do. Well, Marilyn, tell us how you're doing now.
I'm doing fine. In January, I'll have 21 years free of compulsive gambling. I do have a compulsive obsessive personality, and I really don't care what people call me, whether they call me an addict or not. The most important thing in my life today is that I found recovery. I found a way to stop the addiction, all of them.
You started a 12-step program for women. Why?
Yes.
Why? Why for women? And
well, when I went to my first meeting, this was 21 years ago, there were no women in the program in the state of Arizona. When one would come in, I would notice that the men would ridicule them, like, oh, you play the slot machines, that's not even gambling. Oh, you lost $200, well, you lose $20,000. And then they were hit upon, come to my house, your husband just doesn't understand you. And I thought, there's got to be a way to keep these women. So I had a very tiny apartment, and I invited three women to come to the apartment, and we started the first women's group of female gamblers in recovery. As far as I know, it's the first one in the world. We now have probably 10 or 15 women's groups just in Arizona, and I think four of them are Spanish-speaking, and now they're all over the world.
Mm. What a wonderful...
And the women are staying at last, and today men understand their addiction, and they welcome into the program.
You know, we had a show on education, and one of the things we learned is that mixed gender education, mm-hmm. boys do better than girls, and segregated education, boys don't do so well, girls do better. And that's,
I think that's the old tradition where the men know more than the women, and it's been like that for many, many years. It's changing in America, but in other countries it's still men are smarter than women.
Well,
in the mixed groups that maybe the women hesitate to speak up.
Yeah, and we're finding that slowly but surely it's even changing around the world. Unfortunately, we are out of time. I want to thank all three of you so much for joining us. We've been talking about addiction with Marilyn Lancelot. She's written extensively about women and addiction, and she started a 12-step program in Arizona. Now, apparently, they're all over the world, all over the country. We also had Jim Pappas, who is the CEO of the Council on Compulsive Gambling, and C.P. Mirarki, who's an addictions counselor and has his own history of compulsive gambling. Thanks so much to all three of you. Well, next week on the show, we're going to be talking about welcoming back military personnel. Not just what are the issues for them, but what do they need from us? What can we do for them as individuals and neighbors? Well, if you've got a question or idea, we're at whyy.org/voices. I'm at drdangottlieb.com. The engineer today has been Fred Snyder. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our volunteer. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn's our producer. And I'm Dan Gottlieb.